I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for September the 29th. Coming up on this week's podcast, everything you wanted to know about hurricanes but didn't have a meteorologist around to ask. We speak to one of the world's leading authorities on how climate change is intensifying the destructive power of winds. Also in the show, we hoped we'd never find out, but we did. We bring you evidence of James Randerson's time in prison. Plus, harnessing the power of the ocean, a faked spacewalk, and a man who crossed the English Channel with a jetpack. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In the pod with me today, it's James Randerson, the Guardian's science correspondent. All right, James?
Yeah, very good, thank you.
Good, good. Yeah, Some evidence on him later. Nell Bowes from the Guardian's Arts Squad is back. Nell, you've been away again.
Yes, sea kayaking, whitewater rafting. It's a tough life.
You're so middle class, it hurts. Good to have you both. Now let's start with some wind. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, we're coming to the end of the 2008 hurricane season. Although hurricanes such as Gustav and Ike have caused billions of dollars of damage this year, there's been nothing yet to rival the mayhem caused in 2005 after Hurricane Katrina battered New Orleans. All the damage, of course, often makes people wonder whether climate change is increasing the number and strength of the hurricanes we see around the world. I put that question to Kerry Emanuel, an atmospheric scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and one of the world's leading authorities on how hurricanes form and behave.
The first paper about this was written 21 years ago, and the prediction back then has withstood the test of time. All kinds of other people have predicted this too, that roughly speaking, although it isn't just a simple function of the ocean temperature, it's close enough that you can say that for every degree centigrade you warm ocean, the wind speeds will go up by about 6%. But that theory is narrowly conceived. It tells you an upper limit for how strong hurricanes can get, but it does not address how big will the hurricane get physically, how large, how long will it last, and how many will there be. Those are all left unanswered. And so back in 2004, we were looking at a particular metric of hurricanes, which we've become very fond of in the meantime, which is called their power dissipation. It's very analogous to the Richter scale for earthquakes. It's a measure of how much energy is generated by hurricanes over their lifetime, and then over all the hurricanes in a particular season. We came up with that because we thought that energy was a much more direct, useful measure of hurricanes than numbers. I mean, we've had this tradition of counting hurricanes in my profession, which in hindsight is very unhealthy. You would never see a seismologist say that there were 24,632 earthquakes last year around the world. It'd be thought properly crazy. But we got stuck into this mold in meteorology. Everybody wants to count hurricanes. It doesn't make any sense. When you look at the power metric, all sorts of things suddenly become obvious that weren't obvious before. Like, this is spectacularly well correlated with the ocean temperature in the Atlantic, much better correlated than any of the traditional metrics like intensity of storms or number of storms or things like that. And so that was kind of a step forward, although we don't fully understand it. So empirically, though, there's no doubt that as you warm the ocean, the amount of power generated by hurricanes goes up rather spectacularly.
The idea is that this index is a way of tracking the intensity and power of a season of hurricanes over time, so you can see that climate change probably will increase this power dissipation index over time.
Oh, we can see it happening. Yeah. And far before we could see it happening in some of the traditional metrics like intensity. And moreover, it is by accident, I think, to some extent, of much more interest in human beings. The destructiveness of a windstorm goes up with their power, not with their wind speed. Mm. And so we're not really interested in the wind speed or even how many hurricanes we have. We're interested in the sum of the power dissipation, just like nature is. So generally speaking, we expect over a long period of time damage to go up.
That was Kerry Emanuel, an atmospheric scientist at MIT. You can hear my full conversation with him as this week's Science Extra. In that, he talks about how easy it is, or not, to predict hurricanes and reflects on why Katrina was so destructive. Go to iTunes or the website for that. I I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly. Still to come, wave power off the coast of Portugal, plus some jail time for James. Before all of that, though, here's a roundup of the news from the past week. It's Nell and James with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Swiss daredevil Yves Rossi became the first person to cross the English Channel using only a jet-propelled wing strapped to his back last Friday. After two previous attempts were postponed because of bad weather, everything went to plan for Rossi's 9 minutes and 32-second flight. He was helped on his way by a tailwind that cut his flight time by around 2.5 minutes.
Operations at the Large Hadron Collider were suspended barely 10 days after it was launched because of a helium leak last week. The particle accelerator near Geneva was given its first test run on September the 10th, but further experiments have been postponed until the spring. An initial investigation pointed to a faulty electrical connection between two of the accelerator's magnets, which melted, allowing liquid helium to escape.
World leaders have announced an ambitious plan to end all malaria deaths by 2015, which is backed by nearly $3 billion from donors, including the World Bank and the Gates Foundation. A key part of the strategy is a vaccine against the deadly disease, which is now just entering the final stages of clinical trials.
And finally, China's first attempted spacewalk at the weekend was overshadowed by a fake story about the mission put out by its state media. Hours before the successful launch, Xinhua reported conversations in space that had purportedly taken place between the astronauts on board. The state news agency blamed the blunder on a technical problem.
Thank you, James and Nell. Let's go into a couple of those stories. James, who is Yves Rossi and why was he crossing the English Channel on a jetpack?
Well, some might say he's a complete lunatic, but he does know quite a bit about aeronautics. He's an ex-military pilot. He's also a commercial airline pilot, so he knows a fair bit about how wings work. And he's been developing this wing with four jet engines on the back over the course of a few years, gradually improving the design. And essentially what he does is jump out of a plane, the wing unfurls on his back, he fires up those engines, and he levels off and flies for a kind of about 10 minutes, 12 minutes, something like that. That's about as much as he can do with the fuel that he can carry on board. And he did just that over the channel on a glorious sunny day on Friday.
You were watching this live blogging furiously.
I was.
How was it? Was it exciting?
Yeah, I mean, he is clearly mad, and a lot of it, he's taking calculated risks, but risks nonetheless, because this is, you know, they showed, a few examples of things that had gone wrong in the past, like him having to deploy a parachute before the engines had been switched off and nearly kind of burning through the string attaching him to the parachute, and also going into a spin that he couldn't get out of, where he had to kind of jettison the wing and things like that. So, you know, this is on the edge of possibility, but everything went to plan, and
all,
you know,
it's
amazing.
It's all very Top Gun, isn't it? And then for our lawyers, you don't really mean that he's mad.
He's
a genius. Nell is very excited by this man.
So are you going to find him and try out? I mean, how much does a wing? How much does the wing weigh? Is it? Can you just strap it on your back and go?
It's heavy, particularly with the fuel in. I don't know the exact amount. It's
how
two.
Can you strap
it's two
four
and a half
jet
feet.
Engines to your back without breaking your back? I mean, it must be very heavy.
It's pretty heavy. It's two and a half meters across. I mean, he can stand up with it on, so it's not absolutely ridiculously heavy. But it's not
quite Rocketeer territory. But it's getting there.
It's getting there. Yeah. I mean, but obviously, of course, when he's in flight, the wing is acting as an aerofoil, so it's giving him lift. And so the weight is, you know, obviously he's trying to keep the weight down as much as possible.
How did he land? Did he just fall out of the sky?
He did loops.
Well,
did he do like a victory roll?
He got kind of, yeah. He did a kind of a loop around the, a sort of horizontal loop, if you like, around the crowds who are watching, because he got there so quickly. He still had some fuel left, so I think he was just burning off the rest.
He
was showing off. And then what he does is he just puts his parachute up and glides down. He hasn't worked out how to land yet with the thing.
If this was in The Simpsons, the parachute would go up and it would burn because of the jet fuel. Yeah. Oh no! Anyway, on to China's faked space conversations. What happened there? The Xinhua released details of conversations that supposedly took place in space. Is that right?
Yeah.
What were they saying? Hi, I'm in space. Welcome.
Well, it was essentially a report of what they were hoping would happen before it happened. You know, it wasn't just the report of the conversations. It was also, you know, we tracked the spaceship and everything went to plan, and this is what
were
the astronauts said to each other.
Or...
Well, it's hard to know, really. I mean, one imagines that they had this story ready to go in case something went wrong, just to prove to the world that it had all been fine so that they could kind of cover it up. I mean, who knows? It's bizarre. It's, you know, you never know with the
it's
Chinese.
It's the kind of thing which is going to give moon landing skeptics
absolutely. The conspiracy theorists are going to absolutely love it. But it's on the same sort of lines as this girl who, at the Chinese opening ceremony of the Olympics, who was lip-syncing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a similar kind of thing
it's
to that.
It's funny rather than serious in any sort of way. But, I mean, we do believe that they have gone into space, don't we?
They have gone into space. What we don't know, I mean, by the time you're listening to this, they may well have done their first ever spacewalk. We don't know that at this stage.
It's incredible, considering that they only first went into space a few years ago, and they're now already doing spacewalks, and they probably get to the moon quite soon as well.
Yeah, it's a fantastic
it's absolutely
achievement.
Incredible. It's brilliant. It's amazing what... It's amazing what autocracy can do to scientific research programs.
And having lots and lots of people at your disposal.
Lots of people, yes. Final thing, LHC... To much annoyance, it's gone down.
The regular LHC slot
that's
in the
right.
show.
This is the LHC spot, just to let you know the Higgs boson has not been found this week. Nell, as a science fan, are you disappointed that the LHC is a bit... It's sort of let us down a bit, hasn't it? It was so much hype and stuff, and then it just doesn't work.
There's a lot of hype, and the BBC did that whole day.
Well,
except that I kind of wasn't really expecting anything to happen.
But you weren't expecting
months.
It to fall over as well, were you?
My flatmate was deeply, deeply disappointed, having had all the build-up and the...
And it was exciting. The build-up was exciting. It was all brilliant. And then, just literally, it was one circuit that melted.
Was it because of the hype that they kind of launched it too early? Or?
Well, if you speak to some of the scientists involved, because they were trying to get this thing done as quickly as possible, what they didn't end up doing was some of the warm... testing, so you know, because they had to cool this all the entire sort of ring down to minus 270 Celsius with liquid helium. And before they did that, of course, they had to test all the components. There are millions of wires and circuits and things, and they had to do it all in warm temperatures so that you could actually work down there. And I think that they might have missed out a couple of the bits of testing. I know no one's suggesting it's because of that this has happened, but it was literally
it's just one
from
circuit
what I understand,
went,
it was just one or two wires or something on the very last bit of it. I mean, it's a massive machine. Everything, it's a prototype of itself, basically. So it was bound to go wrong.
There was always going to be something.
And I think
wrong.
The whole media circus around it created an artificial start date anyway. I think fine, it got lots of attention. But what were you expecting?
I can only imagine that they are breathing a massive sigh of relief that this didn't happen on the day.
Yeah.
Because that would have been awful. At least the media circus has moved on somewhat.
They started it it's fine, and then...
The spotlight of publicity is still kind of a little bit on there, but most of it's gone away. And so, you know, they didn't get completely slated, but they would have been ripped apart.
They're going to have to warm these places up to fix everything, and then, because CERN closes down for Christmas anyway, celebrate God, who knows.
Celebrate the God particle.
Celebrate the God particle. They're not going to get back up and running until about spring, so which gives the Tevatron at Fermilab some more months, but they're pleased.
Ooh.
Some more months to do to look for the boson in question. Actually, we've got a quite nice blog on the science blog. Got a nice post up there just talking about what particle physics junkies can do for the next few months if they're disappointed about this. While they're waiting. That's right. And we mean all of you listeners out there. We're going to leave that stuff there. Remember, you can comment on all of this at the science blog. That's guardian.co.uk/science/blog. It brings a new meaning to the phrase doing bird. Thousands of prisoners across the country are turning their jails into some of the most species-rich sites in the country. James spent a day at Her Majesty's pleasure to find out more.
Prisons bring to mind images of razor wire, imposing concrete walls and violent tattooed men. But Britain's 140 prisons are home to an astonishing array of rare species, from barn owls and kingfishers to adders and slowworms. Across the country, the prison estate includes 9 internationally recognised sites of scientific interest and 2 European special areas for conservation. I went to Bullingdon Prison near Bicester to find out more about what staff and inmates are doing to foster biodiversity. I spoke to Stuart Jenkins, the prison's head of facilities. So we're inside the prison grounds now. Could you describe to me where we are, Stuart, please?
This particular area at the moment is called Land-Based Activities, which is the old name was Farms and Gardens. Up in this area, they do all sorts of work. They grow all the flowers for planting around the prison. They do various workshops, as you can hear in the background, the noise, where they make planters, bird boxes, bat boxes, anything that they can get materials for and they can build, they'll have a bloody go at building.
Can I ask what your name is, please?
My name's Richard.
What sort of work have you been doing?
Well, we've mainly been doing recycling work, making all sorts of stuff out of the pallets that are left over from the prison. Bird boxes for the RSPCA, RSPBB rather. The dove coops, miniature wheelbarrows that the officers buy and the public buy.
And how long have you been doing that kind of work?
We've been doing that for about 2 years now. I've actually been up here for 3 years, but when I first came out, all the wood shop used to produce was firewood. But then we expressed an interest in actually making something creative. So rather than just chop firewood, we started making wheelbarrows and bird tables and bird boxes to make use out of the stuff that we were breaking up.
The birds mainly that we have a lot of are the tits. We get a lot of blue tits, great tits nesting. We get a lot of robins nesting. In the owl boxes, we don't unfortunately get owls. We seem to get squirrels and pigeons, which are sort of taken up, but no way to stop them from getting in. Bats, we have on site, we have the pipistrelle, we have the natterer's bat, and we have seen flying over the top something called a noctural, but we don't know where they roost. We do believe we have a summer roost at the far side of the prison from where we're stood at the moment, but we've done various surveys, and the little buggers don't come out while we're watching for them. But there are signs of them around the place.
We've got a robin that lives very close to the wood shop, which is where I work, and he comes in the wood shop sometimes. Quite a cheeky little thing. He tends to like pork pies.
What sort of skills have you gained from doing some of these things? I mean, have you learned new things that you could perhaps take with you?
Personally, I was a mechanical engineer, so I tended to work with metalwork and machinery. I've learned quite a lot about woodworking, and I've learned a lot about the biodiversity side of gardening. Obviously, because we're not allowed harsh chemicals and things in the prison, so we've learnt to do it a natural way, which personally I think is best.
Could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm James.
Tell me about the beekeeping activities that have been going on.
Well, it was a new experience for me, being from the city originally and coming in and just knowing and learning about bees. We started off just cleaning out old hives, and just learning about the different structure that a bee actually produces itself for the hive. For example, it puts a natural bacterium on the hive, and that's what you've got to remove. And you know, you just take it for granted all the mess on there is actually mess, and you've got to take it off, when in fact a lot of it's quite useful for the bee. It's been quite a good learning for me, knowing, you know, that the fact that the bee is in danger is quite alarming, because I didn't realize that at all. So a lot of people mistake them for wasps, for example, and just squash them, you know, and that's what I used to do in the past. Unfortunately, I'm reluctant to say it, but it's been quite a good learning. And just for future use, and if the bee is going to be in, you know, in danger, it'd be good to know in the future what to do for it. So it's quite good and quite keen to learn.
What would you say to those people who say, well, prisoners shouldn't be allowed to do interesting things while they're in prison? They ought to be here, locked in their cells, having a very boring time thinking about what they've done.
I don't think that's a very constructive way to think about things. I know that for people that maybe can't go back to a career that they once had, I think it's very important to learn new skills and be positive about the prison experience. Obviously, we are locked up for a certain part of the day, but it's about what you do in that time and how you manage the time, more than actually just sitting there and dwelling on things, because I don't think that's constructive at all.
What would you say to those people who might say prison shouldn't be a place where you go to enjoy yourself?
It's not a place for enjoyment. This is not an enjoyable place. These prisoners here working, they're not actually enjoying themselves. They have a set routine where they have to be at work at a set time, finish at work time. It's properly done as if it is a works regime outside. So it's not a soft option.
And do you think that by doing these kind of activities, it means they're less likely to reoffend when they come out eventually?
Yes, I think it develops a trust with them. They feel better with themselves and everything else. And I think at the end of the day, if we get one guy who doesn't reoffend from what his project work is up here, we've succeeded in what we're supposed to be doing. And I think we will have that here in this unit.
So, James, how come there is so much biodiversity in these places?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, they're all these kind of internationally recognised sites. And the main reason for that is that the prison estate is a very large area of land, and a lot of it is land that people rarely go onto because it's sort of controlled land. You know, it forms a kind of barrier around the prisons very often. I mean, one is a Ramsar wetland that surrounds a prison in Norfolk called North Sea Camp, and basically there's this huge salt marsh around it, which is very significant for wading birds and migrating birds, which is managed by the prison, but it also happens to act as a very effective barrier to trying to escape, because if you get out, you just get stuck in the marsh. It's that sort of thing. But on top of that, you know, they're building bird boxes, managing areas within the prison for sort of, you know, barn owl prey and things like that. So it's, it's quite interesting sort of
Nell,
stuff.
Nell, do you want to ask the Daily Mail question?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to get all Daily Mail and say, so there they are, they're building bird boxes and they're gardening and things. Are they supposed to be staring at cell walls? Is this punishment?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very legitimate question, because, I mean, the prisoners that I spoke to were, you know, quite a few of them said, yeah, I enjoy this kind of work, it's really interesting. And a lot of people, perhaps victims' families, would say, you know, I don't want them to be enjoying themselves, I want them to be having an awful time in there. I guess the answer to that, and this is the answer from, you know, the prison authorities, is that the punishment is the loss of liberty. Yeah. It's not that there's kind of extra punishment in there. The good side of it, I suppose, is, you know, by building bird boxes and bat boxes, they might be learning new skills that they can use on the outside. They might be, you know, providing a service to the community, which is, you know, arguably a good thing. And just generally, you know, by having a routine that involves having a bit of self-respect, having to get up in the morning and do something, it might just take them out of a mindset which leads them into crime, perhaps. I mean, the evidence that it actually does rehabilitate them is pretty flimsy and anecdotal. I mean, you know, they say, you know, we've got examples of people who've, you know, got work in kind of the Forestry Commission or whatever after they've come out of prison. But, you know, there are isolated cases. I don't think you could sort of scientifically document that it's working in that sense, but that's the impression that people have.
I think that we'll get the producer to fade up Heal the World at the end of this. But you can read James's diary of his prison time at guardian.co.uk/science. We're going to go through some of your responses to our blogs next. James, take it away.
Rainbow Bob's comment was, nice to see the GM crops pop up again. Come round every so often when Monsanto finds another patsy. I'm beginning to see GM as the subprime mortgages of the food supply, making the polluters rich until we find it has fouled everything up. And then we starve.
And then this was in response to James's story about Ian Pearson, the science minister, talking about how GM is needed for you know, to feed the future. Wiz55 on our blog said,
why don't they admit it? The rice affair was the media's fault. A lie in the first paragraph is not excused by truth lower down. The Royal Society moved him to get rid of the embarrassment. That's about it.
And that was in response to James too?
Yes, well, this is obviously the story about Michael Rice, the former Director of Education at the Royal Society, who resigned, stroke, was pushed over the creationism comments that he made. And, some of the media reporting was, well, difficult.
Well, if we were to blame the media, as we do every week, on everything, I mean, you know, there's going to be nothing left. the commentator was right, though. I mean, those, as you said last week, the subtleties of that situation were lost, because even though if you read the entire story, you'd get what he was saying in terms of, you know, if people bring up creationism in your lessons, it's your duty bound to sort of discuss it. But he wasn't advocating it as a alternative to evolution.
It's true, the top of my story, our story, was, you know, lacked subtlety, but you know, I think the Royal Society ought to be probably bigger than that.
I think this should be more sophisticated. I think I blame the Royal Society. Anyway, anyone who surfs knows there's plenty of energy in waves, especially big ones. But how do you harness that power if you want to use it for something other than just riding tubes on your board? A Scottish company thinks it has the answer. Palamis Wave Power has designed and built a device that rides waves using the motion to drive small generators. It looks like a long sea snake, but farms of them could become an important source of clean electricity. Last week, the first ever commercial-scale wave farm was opened off the coast of Portugal, and I went to take a look. I'm standing on the bow of the Corte Real. This is a 3,500-ton Portuguese Navy frigate, and we're en route to the world's first commercial-scale wave power station. We're moving at quite a clip. I just spoke to one of the sailors, and it's about 10 knots, she told me, that we're going at, which doesn't seem like a lot, but certainly feels it. Judging by the queasy green faces of the journalists around me, I don't think I'm alone in thinking that we're going quite fast. It's quite a bouncy ride, this. At this speed, we're going to reach the wave power station in about half an hour. It's 3 miles off the coast of a town in southern Portugal called Água Caduri. When it's up and running fully, it'll generate 2.25 megawatts, which is about enough for 2,500 homes.
I'm Ian Shaw, and I look after the project from Babcock & Brown's perspective in Portugal.
We're looking at one of the Palamas devices. Can you just give me a description of what we're looking at?
Essentially, it's a long tube. It's around 150 metres in length in total. It's 3 metres in diameter. So it's equivalent, really, to a commuter train. And it's actually hinged in three positions. And at each part where it's hinged, that movement in the waves moves hydraulic oil, and that goes through a generator which produces the power.
Can you tell us what the scale of this wave power farm is going to be?
This first project is three wave energy generators, and they're each 750 kilowatts. So it's relatively small, but you have to remember that it's the first commercial-scale operation. But the idea is then to look to develop further projects and expand those around the rest of Portugal.
It's been designed in Scotland, the Palamas device. So why is the first sort of commercial-scale version of it here in Portugal?
Well, the prototype was installed in Orkney, but we'd already started developing the project down here. And I think it's fair to say that the Portuguese government has moved forward on wave energy more quickly than has happened in the UK. So here we had a feed-in tariff arrangement so that we had a guaranteed price for the power that was produced, and you don't have that in the UK. So the environment here was really better to stimulate the development.
And in terms of this particular project here in Portugal, at the moment it's roughly 2 or so megawatts when it gets up to full speed. How often will it be generating that much power? I mean, what's the sort of intermittency of something like this?
The capacity factor on it will be around 30% or more. So it's actually generating for the vast majority of time, but it's only at full power for shorter amounts of time. But if you compare it to wind energy, wave energy is more predictable and it's more sustained than wind energy typically.
Thanks very much.
I am Manuel Pinho, Minister of Economy and Innovation, and I'm in charge of energy policy in Portugal.
Why is it that you've made Portugal such an attractive place for renewable energy?
Portugal wants to be very good in renewable energy. We are among the top five in Europe, in the world. We think that this can create an industrial revolution, a lot of opportunities for jobs, for research, and we want to be ahead of the curve. So for wind energy, we have provided feed-in tariffs, and the interesting point is that we set an auction process whereby tariffs are below wholesale prices, so we are able to produce renewable energy at a competitive price. That is a very important aspect.
How sustainable do you think that is to provide a sort of subsidy almost for renewable energies? Do you think that at some point they will have to be competitive by themselves?
Absolutely. 15 years ago, wind energy was not competitive. We had feed-in tariffs, and now the price is 4 times below what it was 15 years ago. So I fully expect that with wave energy, this will be the same process. Now it's expensive. In 5, 10, 15 years, it will be lower. And with this, we'll create a sustainable future.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Helicopter just landed. That's great. All right, chaps, any questions on wave power?
Yeah, I mean, I want to know, how much area are we talking about, if we're talking about wave power actually being a serious alternative to a coal-fueled power station. I mean, these four provide what, enough energy for 1,000 homes, was it?
Yeah, so this particular farm, just off Portugal, there's three of these devices, and it's going to generate 2.25 megawatts, which is around enough for 1,500 homes. And wave power, the good thing about it is it's mostly predictable, so it's not like wind, it can just go off whenever. How much space? Well, this particular wave farm, three of them, they're 140 metres long each. It wasn't really that big, so you can imagine that the
but
sea is an enormous place.
But they're not generating that much.
No, they're not.
You're talking about
they're
sort
not.
Of,
so
each it's
got to
be close enough to the coast to
one,
take the power out, so you're
yep.
talking about barricading a large section of the coast to traffic. And
well, think about it in this terms.
You're thinking about this like a sailor, aren't you?
Offshore wind farms are much more complicated to build, and people do build lots and lots and lots of them, and people have built oil rigs, all sorts of things, so logistically it's not an issue, and it's actually, in fact, it's much, much easier to do this than it is to build an offshore oil rig or a wind farm, and because they're much simpler devices. So in terms of area, well, it's hard to know how much area you'd want for it, but just to give you an idea of the resource, tidal power around Britain, for example, we've got the Atlantic Ocean on one side of us, so there's huge amounts of wave power. No one's worked out exactly how much, but they know that there's more than we would ever need in the UK if you were to able to harness it all. I mean, then you could do say that about solar power as well. There's enough falling on the UK probably to power it all as well. It's a case of actually getting the technology to be cheap enough to implement and simple enough to maintain and all that sort of stuff.
When can I install it on my private or in the shore?
Do you have an ocean-facing property?
I do, yeah.
You could buy one.
No,
I mean,
not on my private island.
You could buy one probably tomorrow. They work. I mean, this stuff's been in development.
Are they likely
years.
To be brought to Britain fairly
well,
soon?
Well, the company that makes them, Palamas Wave Power, is Scottish, and the technology was invented in Edinburgh. They've been working on it for a decade. They are bringing it to the UK. It's going to be part of something called Wave Hub in a few years, which is this project off the coast of Cornwall, which is going to look at actually harnessing wave power. The thing is that where we're at with wave power is where we were at with wind power 20, 30 years ago. There's lots and lots of different ways of harnessing this thing. No one's quite sure what the best way is, so there's lots of different designs. At some point in the next decade, that's all going to shake down. But once that happens, it's just a free, endless supply of energy. I mean, it's quite incredible how reliable and how much there is.
Is there any connection with Salter's Ducks here? Because, of course, Salter was at Edinburgh University, and that was a pioneering design for harnessing wave power in sort of the 70s and early 80s, but it eventually died.
I don't know if there's a direct connection between Salter's Ducks and this, but what that does show is that it's not new, the idea of getting power from waves. I mean, we've been able to do this for a long time, and the reason it hasn't happened is because coal was just really cheap, and oil has been really cheap, relatively speaking. But as, you get to $100 a barrel oil or more, the economics of all this other stuff becomes very viable. So, it's something to look out for. I just think it's a shame we're not doing it here first in the UK, and that all this technology is being exported elsewhere. The Portuguese government is doing phenomenal amounts on renewable energy. Anyway, on that positive note, we'll wrap up this week's show. My thanks to James and to Nell. Remember, you can get the full conversation with meteorologist Kerry Emmanuel as this week's Science Extra. Go to guardian.co.uk/science for that. You can also find our blog on the website, so leave your comments on the show there, or you can write on the Facebook wall. Science Weekly was produced by Kate Taylor. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.